well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Thanks so much for being a part of the program today. We're going to be talking with Mark Namati. He is the CEO of Grab a Gun. You may have seen some of the headlines about the company in recent weeks. They're about to, about to go public. Anyway, it's a fascinating story, and they are hoping to be the Amazon of online gun sellers, which is pretty interesting. So we'll talk about that and what that means, as well as, Mark's thoughts on the current state of the industry and how Grab a Gun, what the plans are for supporting the Second Amendment community once they go public. In fact, let's go ahead and get started. I do want to let you know that we've got a fascinating recidivist report coming up, as well as a interesting armed citizen story. So be sure to stick around after the interview for those as well. But right now, let's take you to our interview with Mark Namati, CEO of Grab a Gun. Take a look and a listen. Mark, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's good to talk to you, sir.
Yeah, I appreciate having the time today.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I appreciate you carving out a couple of minutes as well. So let's ask him. I'll just start with that sort of 50,000 foot level question. What is Grab a Gun all about? What's the elevator pitch for this company?
Yeah, so Grab a Gun, we've been around for about 15 years. We're an e-commerce retailer. Firearms really is kind of the, I guess, external viewpoint. So we sell firearms, ammo, accessories, all that kind of stuff all over the internet, all over the country. Besides that, though, we've really developed on the back end a really substantial tech stack. My background is in software development. So we have a tech stack that really streamlines a lot of our compliance. As you know, in the industry that we're in, there's a lot of regulations, which cause a lot of different complexities, slowdowns within the whole buying process. So we've developed software to kind of streamline that, which helps consumers, helps us. Additionally, a lot of our supply chain, the way we purchase stuff, we have a lot of automation in there, starting to use a lot of AI stuff as well these days, which helps us become more efficient, which allows us to kind of reduce our overhead and reduce our costs and pass those savings on to our customers. So that's Grab a Gun that it's been so far. Obviously, I think we're here today to talk more about the transaction that we're undergoing. So we are doing a SPAC merger with a group called Columbia, which is taking us public. So shortly, we will be listed on the New York Stock Exchange under the stock symbol PEW, P-E-W, which I think a lot of people in this industry get a good chuckle at, but it's kind of cool. And then the plan there is to kind of, we'll have a buttload of cash afterwards. And the plan really is to expand, grow a lot of our software driven efficiencies throughout the industry, some vertical integrations and things like that to kind of become the big player in the space and add more legitimacy to this industry that's been kind of attacked for a long, long time.
How do you see this? And I don't disagree with you about this industry being attacked. We just saw the Supreme Court, thankfully unanimously rule against Mexico's lawsuit against Smith & Wesson and other gun manufacturers, which claimed that they were the proximate cause of cartel violence. As I'm sure you're well aware, we see lawsuits against gun makers, gun sellers, distributors, everybody in that sort of chain where, I think this industry is demonized as a whole. So what do you think Grab a Gun going public does to legitimize the industry and not necessarily just the company?
Yeah, so it gives us another avenue or an option where the public gets a voice to invest in values that they align with. So on the public markets, there isn't a lot of ways for people to do that. This industry has always been short on capital because ESG mandates from private equity or venture capitalists. With us going public, it's kind of a way around that. So we can really grow and expand and kind of face those challenges head on.
Has that impacted you? We see within big banks, in fact, Citi announced this week that it was walking back its policy that required folks in the firearms industry to undergo these, sort of best practices that went well above and beyond federal law in some cases. Has that impacted you guys personally? And again, I thought it's interesting that you bring up not just necessarily the big banks, but the investment groups, right? Having access to that capital, not just necessarily loans, but getting those investors in as well. Is that a big roadblock to companies like yours and others within this firearms industry space?
Yeah, I mean, restriction of capital blocks any sort of innovation or growth within any industry. So again, I'm a software guy. If you think of typical software development, you know, the VCs and all that out in Silicon Valley, they typically will develop this cool new software, whatever it may be for whatever industry. They get a bunch of people subscribe to it. They sell it for a profit. They're selling it to VC company or to private equities. So they have an ability to exit. In this industry, because there's no money, there really hasn't been any sort of driver for growth or innovation when it comes especially to software, because why would you invest time and effort and energy if you don't have a way to monetize it when you're done with that? So that's also kind of part of it. The city thing is interesting because like others, not necessarily financial providers, but software providers have been out there too. Well, they've had a similar thing where they're like, you know, we'll sell the software into your space provided you follow these guidelines. Also, these guidelines could change at any time at a whim. And the way our contracts are written is that if you don't abide by it, then you're off the platform. So, but then you have people coming around and saying, no, no, now we want the firearms community to play. We're willing to work with you guys. But in the case like Citi, it's all great that they said that, but what does that actually mean? Are they actually going to do anything? Is there any gestures that are going to happen that say we actually support the space, or is it just all a publicity stunt and just, you know, no point? So same thing, I guess, goes with social media. Zuckerberg came out, what, a month, 2 months ago, saying that they were going to allow more of that stuff. You know, historically, Grab and Gun has had an issue. We had our Instagram page deleted maybe a year ago. And we weren't selling guns online. We were just literally posting pictures on white backgrounds of, hey, Smith & Wesson or Ruger had a new product release. And they're like, nope, ban that, kill that. Oh, too many posts have been shut down, you're shut down. So a lot of that, we'll see if it's talk or if there's actually any teeth behind it and if they're actually going to help the space or not. But we've had various interesting issues.
So. Yeah. Well, you know, so to that end, I mean, I'm curious when this, when Grab a Gun goes public, is that something that, like, how is that going to impact, again, as you say, you know, these restrictions that come from social media? I know that, I don't know if it was Don Jr. who referred to Grab a Gun as being sort of the Amazon of online gun sales, but, you know, when I was on Amazon a couple of days ago, there's little video screen in the corner and there's somebody doing a live stream and they're talking about a product. Is there a way and is there an intention for Grab a Gun to sort of circumvent social media? Do you think you'll be doing some stuff in-house so that folks aren't just going to the platform to purchase a gun, but they're also going to get reviews, they're going to get you know, commentary or things of that nature? Is that something that that you'd like to see Grab a Gun expand into as well?
Yeah, we'll definitely start doing more content development. We do some today. Typically, we rely on like customer reviews and customer content. I do see an avenue for us to start getting more content out there. Additionally, with our partnership with the Columbia team and Donald Trump Jr., we now have a, you know, pretty expansive voice, I think, which will leverage, which we can push our brand as well, because we are limited by, again, Amazon, Facebook, Google, the world. We can't spend ad dollars promoting stuff. And even if we do get some influencers to, you know, put some media content on YouTube as an example, if they post a link to Grab a Gun within their comments, they're either shadow banned or that video is blocked or they're demonetized or whatever that is. So we have several different options, I think, as we grow to kind of to get around some of those restrictions to try and help ourselves as well as the rest of the industry have a more voice, especially when it comes to digital media.
Yeah. Well, I wish you the luck, all the luck in the world on that, because, yeah, I mean, this is something that's impacted, you know, as you say, influencers, gun tubers, and some of these retroactive decisions, right? They, you know, you talk about the sort of arbitrary nature of these terms changing from a you know, from a business standpoint. That's happening to these, you know, individual influencers as well, where all of a sudden, hey, you know, these hundreds of videos that you've done that were monetized, now we're going to pull them, right? Now they're not going to be able to be accessed because we've changed our terms going forward, and that's a huge issue. Again, maybe not something directly related to what you guys are doing with Grab a Gun, but I'm sure it is going to have some sort of impact. So let's talk about the timing of this. When is Grab a Gun actually going to go public, you think, Mark?
Yeah, so right now, since we're going via a SPAC vehicle, the SPAC is public trading under Columbia or CLBR. We filed our filings with the SEC, so we should be what's called deemed effective here shortly. Again, it's a government entity, so really don't know how long, but you know, we're expecting we should probably be on the stock exchange under Pew in the next handful of weeks.
Okay. That's exciting. And, you know, do you think that your existing customer base, will they see changes right away when that when you guys are start to be publicly traded? Or will they even notice, you know, on the website? Will there be a change for the customers that you already have?
Not a direct change, I don't think. It will allow us to offer, I think, more optionality when it comes to products, maybe better pricing. You know, our plan really is to go make some strategic acquisitions, which will overall elevate the whole brand, whether those roll in straight into the GrabAGun.com retail site that the customer is going to see, kind of remains to be seen on what those acquisitions end up being. So in short, I don't think they'll see much of a difference. We're still going to stay and offer that, that same great user experience and shopping experience and customer service experience that we've had for a decade plus. So, they should still expect great service from us.
Are you concerned at all? Maybe I should say, how concerned are you about what we're seeing at the state level, right? I mean, you know, in DC right now, I think that we're in a pretty good space as far as blocking any anti-industry moves. But, you know, we've seen attorney generals in states like New Jersey and New York go after companies wherever possible. California Senate just passed a bill requiring background checks for gun barrels. Right. I mean, so, you know, that you've got that environment to deal with, too. How do you deal with, you know, 50 states, let's say, you know, 20, 25 of them that view the industry as something to be destroyed, not something to be protected and promoted?
Yeah, I mean, it is a little concerning, especially for the customers of ours that live in those geographies. But we abide by all, you know, jurisdictions and all laws. So we have to, in that example, if that California ban on barrels passes, we're going to have to restrict California customers from purchasing a barrel, which is so ridiculous. I mean, they're not even serialized. They can't even force it, and they know they can't enforce it. But to that end, a lot of other stuff that's serialized, obviously we rely on our partnerships with FFLs that are in those geographies to understand, you know, their local and state regulations. But we try and maintain that compliance as well. Long term, I hope there are some changes, some Supreme Court cases that get taken up. It was kind of disappointing when Snope was not really heard. But you know, we'll see how that goes. I'm hopeful that stuff will change. That Duncan case in California, following that one very closely.
Yeah,
if you recall, several years ago we had that Freedom Week, and all our California customers were quite excited for that. So hoping we get something similar that's a little bit more permanent here in the near future, but the system works pretty slow. So
yeah, well, yeah, and piggybacking off of that, I mean, how active is Grab a Gun now in terms of promoting the Second Amendment? Obviously, you know, you're in the firearms industry, but does Grab a Gun have any you know, working relationships with any of the 2A groups? And what are your plans going forward when you've got you know, hopefully more capital and more resources? What would you like to see Grab a Gun do in the 2A space, not just from a commerce standpoint, but from a protect our constitutional rights standpoint?
Yeah, historically, we haven't done too much with that. You know, we try to stay lean and pass a lot of the savings on to customers. So a lot of the money goes into, you know, orchestrating deals versus some of that stuff. With more cash on the balance sheet, I think we're going to make more plays at joining some of these groups, pushing more of that stuff. Our pro forma board has Chris Cox, who you may be familiar with, was the former director of NRA. So he has a lot of connections with lobbying, you know, for pro Second Amendment rights. So we're going to work a lot with him to determine what the best avenue is for some of the options to kind of work with these various 2A rights groups to get stuff done.
All right. Well, listen, Mark, again, I appreciate you carving out some time today talking about this. Would love to have you back once Pew is being traded there on the big board. And again, I mean, any last thoughts you have for our viewers or listeners?
I don't appreciate the time today. I mean, we're very excited on what this is going to do, obviously, for our company. We do also think it's very good for the industry as a whole in the Second Amendment. Again, giving kind of more legitimacy by us being able to play on in the big space with all these finance guys on Wall Street. And we're not going to take that lightly. So we're going to make sure that our voice is heard and everybody else's is too, and that we're here to fight the good fight that we have for quite a while. And then hopefully our customers and everybody in the industry realizes that's what we're doing. So,
all right. Mark Damati, CEO of Grab a Gun. Thanks so much for your time today, man. It was great talking with you.
Thanks, Cam. Likewise.
My thanks to Mark joining us on the program, and wish them all the best of luck there. Mario chiming in as well. It's been a couple of days for Mario, but yeah, he's still sticking around. All right, let's get to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with an unbelievable headline. Fort Wayne man to serve no prison time after reportedly shooting then-pregnant wife. Now, that's just one of those headlines that makes you sit up and say, what the bleep is going on here? And unfortunately, I mean, the news story itself is just as troubling as the headline. According to the Journal-Gazette in Fort Wayne, Indiana, Terry Lee Sowles Jr., age 27, charged with felony aggravated battery, criminal recklessness, and criminal recklessness with a deadly weapon, as well as four counts of domestic battery. Back in April, he pleaded guilty but mentally ill to aggravated battery by entering a plea agreement, which outlined an 11-year sentence that would all be suspended in lieu of 6 years active probation and 5 years of unsupervised probation. Allen Superior Court Judge David Zint yesterday accepting that agreement, which dismissed Sowles' remaining charges. Now, the shooting happened last April. His wife was in critical condition when she was taken to a local hospital, according to the Journal-Gazette. Sowles initially told police that he had dropped the gun and it fired, striking his wife in the back. A 4-year-old girl was present, though, told police that she had hidden her room after Sowles, quote, hurt her mom. Sowles said his wife had accused him of cheating because of photos that she found on his phone. He denied the infidelity, said his wife didn't believe him. Sowles said his wife placed a gun in her purse as she prepared to leave. Sowles said he planned on locking up the gun in a bedroom, but he threw the gun to the ground after another verbal exchange. He also said the gun did not have a live round in the chamber, so he was unsure of how it fired. Police said evidence showed that the bullet traveled in a straight line through glass. It was not fired upward as if the gun hit the ground and fired, according to court documents. Now, if Sowles had been convicted on all charges, he would have faced up to 45 years in prison. I understand. I don't like it, but I understand that the vast majority of criminal cases in this country get resolved through a plea deal. What is completely unacceptable to me, however, is a violent crime involving a pregnant woman as the victim, resulting in no prison time whatsoever. So I was curious about this guilty but mentally ill pleading. Is that something I thought, well, maybe that was the extenuating circumstance, right? But he wasn't ordered to an inpatient psychiatric hospital. He was placed on supervised probation. So I did a little bit of research about this this particular pleading in Indiana law. First, I found an article from, this was in the Indiana Law Journal from 1982. And I'm not going to read the entire thing, but I'll read the abstract to you. It says, this law, guilty but mentally ill, and other changes in the criminal law were a response to a public perception that the insanity defense constitutes a loophole within the criminal justice system. The public views the insanity defense as a means for defendants to avoid criminal responsibility for their misconduct. However, the guilty but mentally ill statute is an anomaly in the law because it leads jurors to reject valid insanity claims of defendants. It implies a false promise to the jury that guilty but mentally ill defendants will be punished for their crimes and at the same time be compassionately treated for their mental illness, thereby satisfying competing social policies of the criminal law, treatment and responsibility. However, this law review article said, such a ruling actually guarantees no such treatment for defendants convicted under it. A guilty but mentally ill offender is simply a guilty offender for the purposes of disposition upon conviction. And for this reason, the author said, the statute should be repealed. So, all right, so that's what somebody said about the law 40 years ago, right? I mean, that's a long time. Things can change. So I looked up the actual statute in Indiana law as it exists today. And this is what Indiana law says. If a defendant who is found guilty but mentally ill at the time of the crime is committed to the Department of Correction, the defendant shall be further evaluated and then treated in such a manner as is psychiatrically indicated for the defendant's mental illness. But if the defendant who is found guilty but mentally ill at the time of the crime is placed on probation, the court may require that the defendant undergo treatment. Now, there is nothing again in this Journal-Gazette story that indicates that Sowles Jr. was ordered to receive any psychiatric treatment whatsoever. And that, again, is a huge problem. Because you've got a guy who told a story that doesn't add up about how that gun discharged. You've got a woman who was in critical condition, very easily could have died. You've got a litany of charges that were filed against him that could have resulted in a 45-year prison term. And instead, he walks away with 6 years probation, supervised probation, 5 years unsupervised probation. If this is what happens when somebody is found guilty but mentally ill of a violent offense, then Indiana lawmakers need to go back and they need to rework this statute. Because to me, if somebody, again, is that mentally ill that they are committing violent crimes because of their mental illness, then that individual needs to be kept away from society because clearly they pose a danger to themselves or others. So until that mental illness has been addressed, they should be confined to a psychiatric facility. They shouldn't be placed on supervised probation. And again, I get heartburn over all of these recidivist reports, but this one in particular is just, it's sticking in my craw. All right, on to today's armed citizen story. Another interesting one. Here's the headline. Protesters seek justice after manatee judge dismisses case under stand your ground law. Now, the judge in question, not a manatee, by the way, but a judge in Manatee County, Florida. We don't have sea cows on the bench, as far as I know. An interesting case. I have to say, I think the judge made the right call here. The Herald Tribune newspaper reporting more than 24 people gathered outside of the Manatee County Court of Clerk's office on Monday to protest a judge's decision to dismiss a case against a man accused of fatally shooting a 49-year-old Bradenton man after a car crash. Organizers with the Party for Socialism and Liberation Tampa Bay chapter hosted the press conference 7 days after Manatee County Circuit Court Judge Frederick Mercurio released his order dismissing the case against Jordan Glanz based on Florida stand your ground law. And I'm not sure that's actually the case, because the judge in this case said that Jordan Glanz actually had a duty to retreat, but was unable to do so. So Glanz was arrested in July of last year. There was a car crash in which he was the victim, basically, that turned into a fatal shooting. Probable cause affidavit says that Glanz had stopped by a bar to meet his girlfriend last July 10th. He was pulling away from a drive-thru window at an intersection, and a car driven by a gentleman named DeAndrick Anderson ends up hitting Glanz's truck, causing some minor damage. Anderson then stopped his car in the middle of the road. He gets out and walks up to Glanz's window. This is, again, according to the affidavit. Anderson apparently did not want to involve police. He wanted to just exchange insurance information with Glanz, according to the affidavit. Witnesses told investigators that they saw Glanz's girlfriend approach the truck. She became belligerent before climbing into her boyfriend's truck. A witness who was behind Anderson at the time of the argument told police that she saw Glanz purposely spit in Anderson's face, according to the affidavit. And that's when, quote, punches were exchanged. Before Glanz fired one shot at Anderson, hitting him in the abdomen, he then drove home, where he called police. Initially charged with aggravated battery with a deadly weapon, charge was upgraded to second-degree murder after Anderson passed away. In December of 2024, his defense team filed a motion to dismiss under the stand your ground law, claiming that Glanz had acted in self-defense and fired the gun out of fear for his and his girlfriend's lives. There was a stand your ground hearing in May, and Mercurio sided with Glanz. In his order, he said that even though he found that Glanz had a duty to retreat, there was, quote, no reasonable opportunity for him to do so. The judge talked about how quickly things escalated. He also talked about the fact that Anderson's car was parked in the middle of the street, which impeded Glanz's ability to drive away. There was a crowd of people that had gathered around Glanz's truck. There was a car behind Glanz that was stopping him, preventing him from backing up and then driving away. So he was essentially stuck when this guy approached the car. Maybe there was a verbal dispute. Maybe even Glanz's girlfriend spit on the guy. But when Anderson began punching Glanz through the car window, Mercurio found that Glanz did have a reasonable fear of death or great bodily harm. Mercurio ruled that the prosecution had failed to demonstrate that Glanz could reasonably have retreated from the fight once it began. So, you know, the protesters, one of them, Deanna Joseph, founder of the Florida chapter of BLM Grassroots, said, enough is enough. We stand tin-toed style, demanding that this case be re-examined, demanding that the Anderson family receive full accountability to the full extent of the law. I mean, I don't know what exactly can be re-examined here. There was a hearing. The judge did consider all of these circumstances and again concluded that Glanz, who was the initial victim here, whose car was hit by Anderson's vehicle, or whose truck was hit by Anderson's vehicle, had no ability to retreat once the verbal dispute escalated into physical violence. Now, this can be a tragedy for everybody involved. I happen to think, you know, we've covered some of these road rage self-defense shootings, and I hate covering them. I mean, listen, every self-defense story could be avoided if the criminal just didn't commit an armed robbery, didn't invade a home, things of that nature. These road rage incidents, though, they affect me in a different way because we all drive, right? And we've all been angry at other drivers on the road. So, you know, I guess it's a little bit easier to put myself in the position of somebody who gets so annoyed or aggravated or just, you know, enraged by somebody else on the road that they do something about it. I would never do that because I have the peace and presence of mind to just keep driving on down the road. And you know what? 2 minutes later, I've forgotten about it. But not everybody feels that way. Not everybody has that self-control. But to me, these are the most avoidable, some of the most avoidable defensive gun uses, because the perpetrator, the aggressor, in every one of those cases, if they just stayed in their car, if they just turned up the music and sang along to whatever song was on the radio and drove down the road, they would forget what happened within a matter of minutes. So, this is a tragedy. It did need to happen. But that doesn't mean that Glanz was wrong to defend himself and his girlfriend. Anyway, we'll keep our eyes open for any more details. I don't think this case is going to be reopened or reexamined, but we'll see. Finally today, our good deed of the day from Lake Charles, Louisiana, where I got to tell you, I want to live in a place where this is a headline. Good Samaritan returns stuffed animal to little boy. I want to live in a place, I mean, I guess I kind of do live in a place where there's just not much going on. But I love this. I love this story. Here is the little boy in question, along with his stuffed animal. The story itself, by the way, is just as cute as the actual headline goes. So the stuffed animal in question is a stuffed dog named Dog. And Grayson is the little boy who is a dog's owner. As Channel 7 News in Lake Charles reports, Grayson lost Dog last week, but thanks to a good Samaritan in the community, Grayson was quickly reunited with his stuffed friend. Keidra Clark, who's Grayson's mom, says, "We didn't realize we were missing Dog until that night, whenever it was time for him to go to bed, and so we looked high and low for Dog, and we couldn't find Dog." Ashley France was doing some grocery shopping the same night the dog went missing. She said, "I was walking out of the self-checkout on the end, and I saw it laying right there, and I was like, well, that looks really loved. Like, it's not a new toy. Like, it's been through some things," France said. She said her daughter had also misplaced one of her toys when she was young, and she remembered the sleepless nights, the tears. So she said, "You know, I just knew I can't leave that dog just laying there, knowing that somebody out there loves it that much. So I was like, I'm just going to take it. I'm going to put it on social media, and I'm going to see if I can find the owner." So she posted it. In less than an hour, Clark ran across the post, and she was able to get in contact with Franz. Clark says, "As a mom, it touched my heart. You know, something so small. Anybody could have just walked by a little dirty-looking dog and not have thought anything of it. But she took the time to pick it up and actually made a post about it. And not only that, she had over 200 shares. And so not only her, but the people in the community played a big part in helping us find Dog." This is, I think, my favorite part of the story. So before Dog was returned to Grayson, Franz put together a scrapbook some pictures of some adventures that she and Dog went on. Fran said it would help maybe understand where he went. So, like, if he loses him again or something else happens, he would just have a way to put it together that Dog's just having fun. It maybe may get hurt less. So, I don't know, she said. Maybe just something he could look at one day and just a cute little memory that Dog had some adventures. She says that she hopes the Clark family keeps in touch and that Dog is always welcome to come and visit. So, there you go. In the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing for a little boy who had, again, she didn't know anything about it, but for a little kid who had lost his stuffed animal, Ashley Franz, as well as those folks who shared Ashley's post, we thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. Looking forward to seeing you again here tomorrow. I'll be on with the Carl Higbee this afternoon on Newsmax in the 5 p.m. Eastern hour, talking 2A Tuesday stuff. Hope you can tune in for that as well. And be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day. We are keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from across the nation. Yesterday, big legal day. We've got some more legal stories as well, but the legislative items coming up as well. And we'll see if David Hogg stays on the DNC, the vote to either keep him or remove him as a co-chair of the DNC taking place today. So we'll have an update for you on that as well. Enjoy the rest of your 2A Tuesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well. Be safe.